Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. Stick around, a little later in the podcast you can hear Charlotte's interview with Shelton Duprees, who I think has just about the coolest job in the whole yachting industry. Tell us what that is, Charlotte.
Well, it's certainly up there. So he's one of a couple of different yacht videographers I interviewed for a piece that's coming out later in the year. So he's a one-man band. He used to work on yachts himself. He worked his way up from bosun to first mate. And then he realised that the little drone and GoPro videos he was making for guests on board a yacht called Latitude were actually getting a fair amount of attention, and perhaps he should launch into it full time. So his first real gig was as a freelancer in the Galapagos, where he was hoping to settle. But since then, he's literally just hopped from yacht to yacht to yacht. So he doesn't have a permanent base. And apparently he gets less and less sleep during each day of the trip, because he edits the footage during the nighttime and he shows it to clients on the very last day. Anyway, he's had some amazing experiences, including being an arm's reach away from a grizzly bear that he was filming on a jet ski and the engine cutting out, which sounds fairly terrifying. And he's got, you know, he's had incredible experiences swimming within pods of dolphins and doing some amazing stuff up in Antarctica. And he's got some good tips on how to make great yacht videos yourself too. So, well worth a listen.
So he basically just hops from superyacht to superyacht, documenting guests' amazing trips, but obviously gets to experience all of it himself and has to be there on the front line of all those experiences because he's got to record it for posterity.
I mean, he goes to the whole thing. So if you go on shore searching for such and such or going to this super cool restaurant, he comes with you so he can capture it. So it's quite canny, really. But it's interesting, they're increasingly popular, these kind of super videographers who are really high in demand. You have to book them over a year in advance. I think for a long time people have been happy with their crew taking shots on GoPros and drones and things, but actually if you want a really professional film, you have to have a dedicated person on board to do that, who's just spending all their time thinking about capturing the right moments. But it's one of those things that sounds like something you might not need, but then when you see the footage of it, you think, wow, I've got to have that guy on my boat. So it's very interesting.
Well, it's come a long way from the days of just kind of the printed hardback book of photos from your trip, isn't it? And now this is what guests are demanding. I think I'm going to figure out how to fly a drone. I think I can sense a career change. It sounds pretty good to me. In other news, we'll be running another Clubhouse event a little later today. That's if you're listening to this on Friday. So Clubhouse, the new social media app where you can kind of tune into conversations about all sorts of things, really. So we're on there. We're talking about super yachting, but actually on Friday, we'll be talking about sailing yachts and discussing the sailing yacht market and how it's something of a paradox that while the entire super yacht industry is moving in a greener direction, there hasn't been a massive upsurge in sailing yacht orders. So we'll be kind of examining that and talking to a few key characters from the market and also talking about what the future holds for the sailing yacht market. And speaking of sailing, the April issue of Boat International is out now, and it carries a heavy sailing theme. It even has a sailing boat on the cover. We don't get many opportunities to put sailing boats on the cover, but we're very happy when we get the opportunity, and it is Cefeia. Cefeia, Caroline?
Oh, I was hoping you weren't going to ask me. I've been saying Cefeia, so who knows?
Either Cefeia or Cefeia. It's the new flagship from Solaris Yachts anyway, and it is just a gorgeous boat. And we also have the new Southern Wind Morgana in the issue, and Caroline's interview with adventurer Mike Horn, who you might have heard on the podcast a little while ago. But don't fear, there's plenty of power too in the shape of the new custom line Navetta 30 and the Mangusta Grand Sport 30, two very interesting new Italians. So don't miss it. Take advantage of one of our special subscription offers today. Good plug there, or you know, just go grab it from the news agents or wherever you are in the world. If you're in the UK, that might mean grabbing an umbrella, because the weather has gone decidedly drizzly this week after a couple of weeks of spectacular sunshine, which has us all dreaming of warmer weather to come, including you, Charlotte.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like I'm always up for going somewhere hot and sunny, and it has been particularly miserable in the UK this week. But I've particularly been thinking about it because I've been working on this big piece to do with glass and yacht windows. And I was just sort of daydreaming, thinking if I was on a super yacht heading around the beautiful Greek islands or the Bahamas, I'd certainly want to make as much of that amazing view as possible. So the features coming up in our design special, which is in the May issue, and essentially what the piece looks at is all the incredible things you can do with glass on board now that have only just become possible. So this is really recent stuff. In the early 2000s, the regulations about using glass on board were pretty hazy. One of the people quoted in the piece said that the rules were different depending on who you spoke to. And I think that kind of sums it up. Designers and engineers didn't really know what they could get away with, what was legal and what was going to pass muster. Anyway, around the mid-2000s, there was a big change from thermally hardened glass to chemically hardened glass, which basically just meant that clearer and more optically impressive and stronger glass could be used, so that opened things up a lot. Seeing as Stuart's always quizzing us, I thought I would throw things back. Stu, can you name the boat in the mid-2000s that made headlines for how much glass it had on board?
So, lots of glass mid-2000s. I can think of two.
Go on.
Hedging your bets.
One is Rising Sun.
No, it's not that one.
David gets the big boat. Okay. Is it Scat?
No, it was Venus, Steve Jobs' boat. That was the kind of trailblazer. That was the sort of the Kate Moss of yachts, I was thinking. After that, people were suddenly a lot more interested in it. Then came Syzygy 818, which is one of my all-time favourite boats. I'm always banging on about it. That has an entire superstructure made from glass, and there hasn't been a yacht before or since that's quite managed the same feats that boat did. And last year, of course, there was also Artifact, which has these incredibly distinctive sort of geometric windows, which really mark it out. They actually used over 60 tons of glass on board that, and it was all to meet the owner's brief, which was that they didn't want to see any framing around the windows.
So one of the most incredible things I think I've ever seen on a yacht are those underwater lounges on Savannah and Elandis. They just feel like real science fiction features. And the glass tech that went into those was really insane. I know that FedShip, who did Savannah, are pioneers of using glass as a structural material. So the glass on that underwater lounge on Savannah is made up of several panes that they squish together, and together they're at least 2 inches thick. And there's just loads of other innovation in there that I can't recall, so we're probably going to get an angry email from FedShip.
Those are incredibly impressive. The way they're set up on those two boats is kind of like almost galleries, and you can sit there having a cocktail staring out at the underwater scene. It is exactly amazing. But surely beating or trumping both of them is Sailing Yacht A, which has a glass see-through bulb basically fitted to its keel. So you can sit in this kind of reclining lounge space staring out of this glass kind of bulb at the propellers turning underwater. It's meters underwater, so fully submerged. And I remember reading, we kind of broke the story about Sailing Yacht A few years ago. And we mentioned this glass bulb and the testing that had to go into producing this glass. They sunk it to the bottom of this massive, there's a lake with this, it shelves off and it's really, really deep at one point. So they dropped this glass all the way down. This is to test in a high pressure environment, and it obviously passed. Anyway, I've never seen that. I've never sat in that space on Sailing Yacht A, but that is bucket list stuff, I think. I'd love to see that.
The testing's obviously key. It kind of comes up in the piece time and time again that some of the most amazing new tech that exists at the moment, companies don't want to work with other companies because they're worried about anything compromising their product. So, you know, they have this amazing glass and this company wants to do something cool with it, but they don't want to work together because they can't guarantee, you know, they've obviously taken a long time to build up their safety certification and everything and don't want anything to put that at risk. I think it's really changing the shape of super yacht design as we know it. And there's some very cool stuff on the horizon as well. For example, media glass, where you can have a transparent window that can incorporate a completely clear TV. So that already exists. And one of the designers in the piece was saying in the future, you could maybe have the whole bridge be a series of TVs, you know, transparent TVs. And at nighttime, you're not looking through the windows, but you're looking into the TVs instead, with the kind of outline of certain objects on the horizon. So I thought that was very cool and kind of Matrix-esque.
If memory serves, I hope I'm remembering this right, but I remember on Symphony, the big Fed ship, that's got a kind of a passage you walk through to the beach club, but you walk through the engine room, basically. Hampshire 2, it's the same thing on Hampshire 2, and there's a few other boats like this. Basically, it makes a spectacle of the engine room, but on the glass, the see-through, obviously the see-through glass into the engine room, there's like an infotainment panel as well, so you can kind of see specs about fuel burn and speed and distance traveled, all that kind of stuff on this kind of screen, which I think is that technology. It's very, very cool.
Wow. Well, yeah, we'll have to look out for more things like that in the future.
Indeed. So that feature, that fascinating feature about glass and the future of its use in super yachts, will be in the May issue, which is our design special, which is out in April. On with the news. Caroline, over to you.
So the first story we have is about Pershing's newest offering. And I'm going to put my hands up at this point and say I don't know how to pronounce it. So I think it's Tue, but it's got one of those Norwegian, I don't know what he calls it, through the O.
Toy?
Like, toy?
So, okay. what are you pitching?
I'm pitching Tue because I'm too scared to go off-piste with anything.
I'm pitching Toy. I'm going to go Toy.
All right, fine. We'll go with Toy. What do you reckon, Charlotte?
Oh, I was going to go like Toh. I don't like Tue because that's the name of the Sainsbury's clothing brand, which isn't very glamorous at all. I feel like you don't want to be associated with that as a super yacht.
Toh sounds quite Scandi.
Toh.
It is Toh. Quite, yeah, Toh.
Okay,
Toh, Tue and Toy. Okay. If it's not one of those, that's very embarrassing. Anyway, but it's spelled T-O, but the O has a line through it.
Exactly. So anyway, the first hull in Pershing's Tue, Toy or Toh range of high performance sports yachts is well underway and on track to debut next year. The hull of the first 35 meter model has been built at Ferretti Group's mold plant and will be arriving at the yard's Mondolfo shipyard this summer for the last stage of construction. The design is a collaboration between Fulvio de Simone and the group, and Ferretti Chief Operating Officer Stefano De Vivo has previously said that the new range would embody the epiphany of the Pershing DNA. Not wow. quite sure what that means, but it sounds inspiring.
Yeah.
It will be a high-performance boat, and it takes inspiration from the builder's X generation, which has so far spawned the 5X, 8X, and 9X.
Cool, cool boats, those X boats. I remember I had a blast around in the 9X around Monaco a few years ago. That was lots and lots of fun. Very fast, very cool boats.
Absolutely. So I hope to see more along those lines. So this is an interesting tweak to a popular new design. Darman Yachting has redesigned its Sea Explorer 77 expedition yacht model to have an increased focus on exploration lifestyle. It was sparked by a review of the design by the Sea Explorer team, the exterior designer Azure, and EOS Expeditions, which had quite a lot of input into the initial Sea Explorer concept. The change of focus was the result of feedback from clients. So features to suit tropical destinations specifically have now been introduced, including an upper deck swimming pool, a DJ and dance space large enough to hold 150 guests, and they've also added a multi-purpose aft deck that can be modified for owner-specified requirements such as a submarine hangar or storing and deploying a seaplane. And all Sea Explorers are now offered with hybrid electric propulsion and a battery bank.
I'm really excited to see this because I know we've mentioned EOS quite a bit on the podcast before, but I remember speaking to Rob McCullum at EOS when he was working on this. And I know that those guys have put a lot of time and thought into this, and they really do, you know, they're out all the time taking people on incredible trips. So it's always exciting when there's someone who's kind of living the day to day that knows exactly what needs to be on board and what needs to change. Quite surprised to see that what came out of that was a DJ dance space large enough for 150 guests. But I guess that's what they found was lacking and what they needed to put on there. So I would be very confident that that boat has everything that it needs to have on board, given the people involved with it.
Absolutely.
So sticking with Darman, they've also inspired this week's data story, which is, Caroline.
Yeah, so we recently covered the 55-metre Darman Game Chaser, which was delivered after a major refit. That was one of our favourite stories in recent weeks. The support vessel is going to be a very cool platform for scientific research that will accompany Dr. Jonathan Rothberg's AMLS 180 gene machine on her adventures. Jean Chaser is currently crossing the Atlantic to join her mothership in Florida, and you can actually follow that on Instagram if you're interested. But that got us thinking about support vessels in general and their increasing popularity. They're not a recent invention, but more and more have been delivered in recent years, and they really became popular in the mid-2000s. At that time, most of them were conversions of former commercial ships.
And we probably should add at this point, for anyone not massively familiar with the super yacht world, to kind of define what a support vessel is. And that's kind of an extra carrying platform for tenders, toys, subs, seaplanes, helis, that kind of follows the mothership. So a functional platform that follows the mothership to places and just carries lots of cool stuff that frees up space on the mothership for guest areas and more kind of lounges, I guess, and, you know, DJ spaces for 150 guests.
Well, absolutely. Perhaps if I give you some examples of some very well-known support vessels that have launched in recent years, it would help to sort of describe the concept. Mm. So to take another Darman yachting boat, Pink Shadow was launched in 2019 under the name Joyrider and was recently delivered to her mothership, the 53.7-metre Baltic sailing yacht Pink Gin 6. She is helicopter capable with space to carry 2 10-metre tenders and a Land Rover Defender.
So that's really the perfect example there, isn't it? Because obviously Pink Gin, kind of long, lean sailing boat, which doesn't have the volume to carry things like Land Rover Defenders and twin 2-metre tenders. So the owner wants all that stuff, but he can't get it on the sailing boat. So he buys the Darman support boat to run alongside or meet him in an anchorage with all this stuff on it. So that's a good example of the concept, absolutely.
Another one that we actually ran a feature on not too long ago was Hodor. I suppose named after the Game of Thrones character. We've never had absolute confirmation on that, but it's quite a cool name, I thought. That carries 5 tenders, the largest of which is a 17-metre chase boat. It also carries jet skis, quad bikes, has a submarine garage, has dive equipment and compressors, and a hospital with a decompression chamber and a helipad. That is from Incat Crowther, who've actually just launched another support vessel called Wayfinder, 68-metre. Another catamaran support vessel is Echo Yacht's 51-metre Charlie, which serves as the shadow boat for the 84-metre trimaran White Rabbit. Charlie can also entertain guests with a sheltered observation deck and a piano lounge. However, it's her tender storage capacity that is her most notable feature. She can carry a fleet of up to 10 watercraft. And Echo Yachts also have another shadow under construction, so we'll keep an eye on that one. There are quite a few more, and we feel like popularity of these boats has been ramping up in recent years. In fact, the current fleet of support vessels stands at 45, with an average LOA of 59.9 metres. 42% of them are conversions from commercial vessels. 6 more support vessel projects are under construction between 2021 and 2022. That may not sound like a huge figure, but it's about 13% of the total fleet currently in existence.
So would it be fair to say previously, until fairly recently, support vessels tended to be conversions from classic commercial ships, and more recently it's become a more new build phenomenon?
Exactly, and I think there are a few builders that are responsible for that change. So the most notable one is Darman with their popular SEAC series. But you also have Lynx in the Netherlands, Echo in Australia, who we've mentioned, Armon in Spain, and Alia in Turkey. And they're making boats from scratch, whereas perhaps before you had an owner who had a yacht and wanted a shadow vessel and he found a yacht to convert. Now the sort of the pattern is a bit different. Hmm.
I definitely can imagine these kind of getting more and more popular, just because I think the way that people are traveling and the kind of trips they're doing are changing. Like, speaking to the owner of Ocean Dreamwalker 3 earlier this year in his trip to Alaska, it was quite clear that he was constantly going out on helicopters, going out on tenders, going out on jet skis, you know, really maxing out every minute of that 10-day trip. And if you want to do that, you've got to have a lot of kit. But also, if you want to do a big trip like that, you want to bring lots of people with you. So it's kind of the only solution if you want to do that kind of journey. So I reckon we'll see a lot more of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And the order book certainly suggests that's the case. Alrighty, that's it for news this week. Stay tuned for Charlotte's interview with Shelton Dupries.
So I'm joined today by Shelton Dupries, who's the talented filmmaker behind Luxury Yacht Films. If you haven't seen his Instagram page before, I highly recommend you check it out. There you can see everything from incredible footage of sharks to pods of dolphins to polar bears, and even some footage of Shelton trying to perfect his backflip. In fact, it's been making me quite jealous having a look all this morning at the beautiful boats and beautiful locations. So if you're stuck at home, it's a brilliant thing to look at anyway. And in fact, I understand that you're out and about at the moment, Shelton. You're somewhere very exciting. Where are you?
I'm in the Bahamas at the moment. I'm on a really exciting new project here working for a conservation group called Sea Legacy. And so we're out here doing a lot of shooting, mostly underwater, and trying to promote conservation efforts in the Bahamas.
I've heard of Sea Legacy. I know them well. Perhaps you could give a bit more of an introduction to explain who you are and what you do, and perhaps any yachts that you've worked with that you'd be able to mention that people would have heard of.
Sure, absolutely. Long story short, I started in the industry back in 2008. And for the 8, 9, 10 years after that, I worked my way from deckhand to bosun to mate. And it was on one boat in particular called Latitude that I started to pick up the camera and started shooting, started documenting the guest trips. At the time, I was just the mate on board. So as a hobby, I was shooting the guest trips, and it quickly developed into, you know, a passion that I loved doing. And it was a creative outlet for me, as it is for a lot of yacht crew now. And with the timing of drones coming out, with Instagram kind of becoming more of a thing, and boat owners being more open and acceptable to being in the public eye, after a few years of doing that and honing my skill and making a few videos up in the Arctic, I was at a turning point where I was like, okay, I could either continue pursuing being the captain or take this opportunity and use this momentum I have to try and launch into a full-time job of making films and doing photography for the yachts and for guest trips and for promotional content for the boats. So it was about 3 years ago that I decided that I would do this, and initially relying on my contacts that I had made in the industry, I just put a shout out and I said, hey, I'm going to be doing full-time, filmmaking and photography for the yachts. If anybody wants, their guest trips documented, or if they have any charters coming up, let me know and I'll come and shoot your trip, basically. At the time, nobody had really, there's a lot of companies that do the promotional side of things. But nobody at the time had really marketed themselves as somebody who could come and shoot guest trips, right? And just shadow the guests. And so I thought, with a combination of my experience in the industry, how to be around guests, how to be on boats, and now with my experience with filmmaking and photography, I thought it was a good combination. And it took off really quick. And it was a very, very, very crazy few years of just constantly, pre-COVID, obviously, constantly just flying around the world, going onto loads of different boats and loads of different super cool locations, and, getting to do all the cool stuff, shadowing the guests, which, it's just a good time.
And I guess you do come at it from quite a unique position, because I think lots of the people doing footage on yachts now, they're kind of videographers that have segued into the super yacht industry, or they're diving instructors who started off filming things underwater. But you kind of, how a super yacht works from the inside out. How Yes. did you get into, those first jobs on boats? Did you sort of grow up on the water? Did you have an interest in sailing on yachts, or was it one of those fluke decisions and then that sort of led you down one path?
Yeah, it was, I grew up on the beach surfing, diving in South Africa. And so right. I'm half South African, half Canadian. And then when I was about 14, 15, my eldest sister had to join the industry as a chef stewardess. So from a very young age, I knew about the industry and I was like, yep, I know exactly what I want to do. And so basically, as soon as I saved enough money, I think it was just after my 19th birthday, I, you know, flew myself over to Fort Lauderdale and then started working on boats. So it was just a very natural, very easy progression. I knew it from a long time, and yeah, the industry was great for me. That was back in 2007-08. So, it's been a while. I can't believe it's been 13, 14 years now. It's hard to believe, but
I was surprised when you said you've been doing the videography for 3 years only, because yeah. I was saying to Shelton before we started recording, you know, when I was speaking to people and saying, oh, I'm looking to speak to an interesting videographer, everyone said, oh, that's the guy you've got to speak to. So to have kind of built up that empire in 3 years is incredible.
Yeah. Thank you.
Maybe you could talk a bit through the process. So if you are filming a trip for guests or whatever, how does it work? Do you come on board the whole time? How much footage do you take? How long does it take to edit? What's the kind of process of one of your films from start to finish?
Sure. So typically what will happen is I'll fly in the day or two before, just to get kind of like on the boat and get all my gear set up, everything like that. And then that way I'm ready to roll once the guests kind of arrive. The guests are, you know, they're told before that I'm going to be the videographer, the photographer on board for that trip. So then I can kind of just get straight into it as soon as they arrive, shoot their arrival, take photos, do videos. So while they're coming on board, every day I'm shooting photos and videos.
Mm.
And then I typically try to deliver, you know, a handful, maybe a dozen or so nice edited photos at the end of each day. I'll go up to them, airdrop them the photos, you know, say after dinner or whatever, they're all happy with that, put the photos on display on the TV while also shooting video throughout the days and then editing as I go. And then at the end of the trip, have the finished movie to present on the final night of the trip before they leave.
That sounds like quite a time crush. Is it kind of exhausting? Do you tend to do a week and then go home and lie in a heap? Or that sounds like a lot to make sure you get really decent stuff.
It is. And it's 24/7. So typically it's funny. I've noticed there's like three stages. There's the first, second and third of the trip. And the first third, I get like 7 hours of sleep. The second third, I get like 6 hours of sleep. And then by the last third, I'm down to like 4 or 5 hours of sleep per night.
And how do people react to you being on board? Are most people quite, you know, I'm slightly camera shy and I can't imagine having someone filming me the whole time. Are most people pretty up for it? Do you think we're living in a generation now where especially younger people are quite used to kind of, you know, being photographed, being filmed, doing it in return? Or do you find that you sometimes have to coax people out of their shell a bit?
Honestly, people are super, they might be shy at first, but they get into it really quickly. And, mm-hmm. and like, especially after I've delivered, say like the first batch of photos or something like that, you know, where they've seen it and they're just like, oh wow, like this is actually pretty cool. And then they're all for it. Then they're like, oh, take my photo here, take my photo there or whatever, you know, and they get right into it. And then, you know, as the trip goes along, then I can start directing them a little bit more and be like, hey, like, you know, you guys sit over there, I can take a really nice photo of you type thing. People get right into it and they love it. And then, you know, the photos, of course, and then the video at the end, you know, they laugh, they cry, they get excited. They love it. So, you know, people get right into it.
Have you noticed a kind of increase in demand for this kind of thing? Is it just that people weren't really doing it before, or do you think guests are now looking for something more than a few pictures? You know, where's the demand coming from really?
So there was definitely a large shift in the industry. And I mean, crew now, you know, there's a lot of job postings where it's like, we want deckhand, engineer, must have drone flying experience or must have editing experience or something like that. So there has been a big shift in the industry for sure with boats wanting content of the boats, not only for their own promotional reasons, but also to offer that as a service.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, there has been a more of a demand for it, but there's also been a supply for it in the sense of crew being able to do it as well.
Mm.
So it comes and goes because it's not a, It's not a priority. It's not a necessity, right? It's a total bonus, total luxury service. Whereas, say the promotional content, yachts need that. Mm. So that demand has always kind of been around, and that'll always be around. But like the shooting of the guest trips, it's a luxury service. So, you know, and some people are still concerned about privacy and stuff, but it's definitely building. People want their trips shot, and I wish there was multiple of me, because it's really hard. One of the hardest things with this is obviously timing, right? Mm-hmm. And timing jobs and stuff like that, because it's like you commit to a job and then next thing you know, somebody asks, oh, can you do this? And then you can't. And so there is a demand for it, but it's still growing.
And so this year hasn't been any quieter for you then? The kind of the pandemic hasn't had a knock-on effect with what you do and how busy you are?
Yeah, it did for sure. You know, back in March when this all kind of locked down, I lost, you know, like every other content creator and videographer out there, I lost all the contracts, obviously, because everything was just like, nope, shut down. Mm. But luckily at that time I was in, I was on Vancouver Island, and I had just previously met some conservationists from Sea Legacy in Antarctica a few months prior, because I was in Antarctica shooting on a yacht there. And so luckily I was able to get a bunch of work with them, and which inevitably turned into what I'm doing now. So there was a big drop off, obviously, because you know, boats weren't really doing anything. They are now, but people are still concerned about COVID. It's hard enough flying crew in and out, let alone additional services like yacht videographer, filmmaker. So I've had a few lately. So things are definitely changing. I've had a few boats lately reach out and be like, hey, could you shoot this trip? I can't currently because I'm busy, but it is definitely picking up again.
And it's interesting what you say about crew, because like you said, pretty much every boat I know of now, you know, there's a crew member with a GoPro and a drone and everything yes. like that. How is what you do different? How is, you know, if I'm an owner and I'm thinking, oh yeah, well, I can get my crew to make a film of me. Why yeah. is that not the case?
Yeah, yeah. So basically, I've done the dual role thing. I've done it, and I know what you're capable of, and you can get a good product, right? Crew members can grab GoPros, they can jump in the water, they can go down the slide, they can throw a drone up and get a couple of clips, and they can just put a montage together of drone footage and GoPro footage. Put some music to it, sure, it's a good product. But if you want a professional, tailored, personal video that it has captured candid moments, nice audio, nice conversations between people that actually make you feel emotional and make you laugh out loud because of the funny moments, and if you want to capture like the actual essence of the trip and what was going on, it needs to be a full-time commitment. And even me going and doing it full-time, I still run myself harder than I ever did working on deck. Like, really? no comparison, yeah. Literally no comparison. Yeah. And so I always say this, if you want a yacht quality product, then it needs to be a standalone service.
And what about the kit you use? Because looking at your Instagram, there were some things, I don't even know what they were, presumably some kind of drones, but do you have, you know, do you use the same kind of kit as the crew would use, or have you got something that's way, way, way more sophisticated?
I shoot light. Like I travel light, I shoot light just so that I can, you know, carry all my stuff through carry-on, and I don't have to deal with like massive transportation. Like I like being, you know, fast and nimble and being able to, because not to sound cheesy, but with photography and video, it's all about the moments, and especially on the yachts where you can't be like, oh, hang on, can you say that again? So you need to be very fast, and you need to be like ready to go at all times. So I just use very light camera equipment. I use a Sony A7 III. I have a underwater housing for it, so I do all my underwater with that as well. And I use that. I've got like a little mic on top, but it's really just run and gun stuff that anybody has access to. And, you know, the famous saying is the best camera you have is the one that you have in your hand. So you know, for these kinds of trips, it's more important to capture the moments. And I mean, these cameras are incredible. The Sony A7 III is like, I mean, it's an incredible camera. So, you know, a lot of yacht crew buy them and have them, but do they use them? Not typically.
And what are the difficulties of the job then? Because looking at your Instagram again, I saw there was, you know, you in the Maldives hanging out with some gorgeous models, and I thought, you know, it looks like a dream job, but presumably there are, you know, challenging parts to it. What do you think people underestimate, or what do you find difficult?
The most difficult part for me is, it's definitely the part that I miss the most, right? So this job, I mean, it is incredible. Yes, get to travel all over the world, do all this stuff. But because of what I'm trying to do, it's a very like solitary type of life. Like I go from boat to boat and I'm always surrounded by people and it's all good and great. But because like space is such an issue on yachts, like that's another big hurdle that I always have to overcome is like, is there space for me to join on these trips, right? Because usually boats are like chock-a-block. Crew cabins are full. Guest cabins are full. So it's really, that's a quite a hard one. So I'm always doing these jobs by myself. So that's the hardest part, is like constantly doing all this travel, all this shooting, all this editing by myself, essentially. So that's why I'm really happy in this situation that I'm in right now. I'm with a team, and it's like, it's a really fun change of pace. So that would be one of the hardest parts. And then obviously just constantly trying to schedule the trips and schedule where to go in the world, because I don't really base anywhere. I decided, you know, 3 years ago, I was just like, you know what, I'm just gonna roll with it, and wherever I kind of end up, I'll stay and I'll continue to look for work depending on what time of the year it is, and just kind of go from there. So I'm from Canada, but I don't live there. And I just kind of, I go where the work takes me / where I want to spend my time.
And do you think, you know, will you be a sort of filming nomad forever? Or do you think at one point you're going to say, okay, this has been fun, but I need a bit more of a base?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, I gave myself 2 to 3 years, and I'm coming up on that now. So yeah, so I'm feeling it, and I'd love to find a base and like find somewhere to live and put all my stuff and be able to return to, but I just haven't quite found where I want that to be just yet. You know, I tried Fort Lauderdale a couple of times, didn't really love it, so yeah. You know, I had to keep moving on from there. So yeah, but we'll see. I mean, I love Canada, I love Victoria, Vancouver Island, and so who knows where it'll be, but you know, everything's going really well so far, and I'm enjoying it. So, you know, I'm in no rush.
You have been to some amazing places though. Let's talk a bit about that, because I've seen, you know, even just through flicking through Svalbard, Maldives, Bahamas, everywhere, kind of where have you been that you've been like, wow, I would love to come back here? And what's some of the most, if you had to pick your three most amazing moments of video that you've ever captured, what would those be?
Oh, okay. Well, the first one's easy. I got to think about the video capture thing. So I started this whole videography journey as a freelance in Galapagos. And so Galapagos holds a very, very like certain spot in my heart. And I really love it. As soon as I got there, I was just like, wow, I want to try to live here. And I actually looked into it. I looked into trying to live there. It's a nightmare. I have to basically marry a Galapagonian, and it's just like, that's not gonna happen. So Galapagos, amazing. Absolutely love it. The wildlife there, just the entire like energy of it. It feels like a little mini Jurassic Park. So Galapagos, huge, high up on my list for sure. And then I'm also very like attached to both the Arctic and Antarctica. You know, I started doing a lot of my filming up in the Arctic, and you know, I just love it up there. The isolation, the peacefulness of it all, the wildlife, the polar bears, the walrus, like all these incredible animals that live up there. And then just recently, this last year, I did Antarctica on a yacht for the first time. I spent 2.5 months down there, and just again, just otherworldly. You know, it feels like you're on another planet. So those are definitely my three kind of favorite places in the world.
And in terms of kind of moments that you've captured on film, is there anything that you remember? I mean, I saw this kind of incredible pod of dolphins on your Instagram that I thought.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
There's been, definitely the wildlife moments. The pod of dolphins, you know, I've always explained to people, because a lot of people ask me about that experience. And I've explained it, like, to put it in a nutshell, like, if I were to have one last wildlife experience, it would be that.
Yeah.
It's hard to put it into words how incredible it feels to be shoulder to shoulder with thousands of spinner dolphins in crystal clear blue warm water, and just be like swimming along, you know, with the sea bobs, and just be swimming along with them like you're a dolphin. Like, the energy that comes off of them and the whole experience was just absolutely incredible. So to be able to capture that was definitely a huge highlight. Some of the footage was shared onto, like, BBC's Earth, Planet Earth channel and stuff like that. So that was a huge highlight for me and my career, for sure. And then some of the stuff that I shot up in the Arctic as well, with some of the polar bears, you know, they are just absolutely magnificent creatures, and getting to be near them and to shoot them and stuff like that is just, it's a huge highlight. And it's something that I think about often, and any chance that I get to go back to the Arctic, I always do.
Yeah, I'm so keen to go. It looks incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wondered, actually, with all the wildlife and things, and I guess also from what you've said, you know, traveling by yourself and rushing around a lot, have you ever had any kind of hairy moments where, you know, things have gone slightly tits up? Skew if, I should say.
Yeah. Not with wildlife. I haven't had any wildlife encounters. I mean, look, there's the polar bears and that are honestly pretty placid. They, you know, like any predator, they'll take an opportunity if they get one. But if you're smart about it and, you know, you're cautious and you're aware, then you should be fine. I think the one, actually, now that I think about it, the one somewhat sketchy part, nothing bad happened, but I was in Alaska, and I was filming these grizzly bears that were feeding on this whale carcass. And I was sitting on the back of the jet ski, and we were coming in super, super, super quietly and super slow. And as we got closer and closer, the jet ski cut out, and I was left. I was left within, like, arm's reach of, like, a full size grizzly bear eating this whale carcass. And I was, like, whispering to the driver, I'm like, turn the jet ski on.
And yeah, what happened? Did it just kick back into life when you were arrested?
Yeah. Yeah, he just kicked back into life. But I mean, I could, like, feel the warmth of the breath of the grizzly bear.
Yeah, there's that film, Grizzly Man. You don't want to become one of those.
exactly.
And in your kind of downtime then, when you're in between jobs, which sounds like it's basically never, do you film your own trips and your own stuff, or is that your day job? But do you get away from a camera when you're having a break?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that, because I do really love to continue to shoot video and, like, photos and stuff like that. But I typically will just do a lot of phone stuff when it's just me and my own. And I'll try to get creative just with my phone, 'cause, like, I like to, you know, just try to, like, do things with less equipment. And so I'll do a lot of stuff on my phone just in between. And then I do really like to take photos. So the video, I feel like the video side of things for me is definitely more like work. But when I'm on just like a fun trip, or if I go on a hike with some friends or whatever, anything like that, like, I love to take photos of that and then give the photos away and stuff. So photography is more of like a fun pleasure thing for me. And then video is definitely more of like, I'm in work mode.
And what are some tips for if people maybe want to start trying to do a bit of their own film? They obviously, you know, they're waiting until you're available to do something amazing for them. What are some kind of rookie errors or things that you see people do in the industry that you think, oh, that's a terrible film because of X, Y, Z? What are some kind of easy things people can do to make better footage themselves?
Focus on a couple of things: the storytelling, the angles, and just capturing, you know, kind of moments like that. Don't be scared to capture the details instead of just shooting wide and capturing the whole thing all the time. Just get creative with that side of things and focus less on, like, needing the best camera or the best that or the best drone, because in reality, like, I could probably do my entire job with my phone.
Really?
Yeah. And it just, you know, you have, everybody has the capabilities to shoot this kind of stuff with the gear that they have. So I think focusing less on that and more on just like, you know, watching and you know, I learned almost everything. You know, I didn't go to school or anything for any of this. I learned pretty much everything, but just trial and error. You have a question or you see a video where you're like, damn, I really like how they did this movement or they captured this. Go on to Google it, YouTube it, watch it. How do they do this transition? What kind of software must I use? What kind of computers, you know, should I get, you know, cause that is important. Your computer processing power and the editing software and stuff like that.
Right. So. And what kind of response do you get from people when you show them the films? Is it a bit of a nerve-wracking moment for you if you've been kind of tailing people all week and then you're showing them the results? And how does it tend to go down?
Yeah, I'm always nervous, of course, because it's a very personal thing to make any kind of video. You put a lot of your own emotion into it. You've been creative with the shooting, you've been creative with the editing process. So it is quite a personal experience, even if you're making it for somebody else. And so, yes, I get very nervous when it's the night of premiere. I mean, I'm confident in my ability and I'm confident that they'll like it, but it's still, you still get nervous, right? Because you feel like you're exposing a part of yourself, right? And so, I'm not saying this, but so far, knock on wood, it's always been a success. And it's always been very well received. And they, like I said, they typically, there's always a couple tears shed at some point.
Really?
Somebody,
The criers then. If you don't shed a tear, you know that you need to up your game a bit.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's usually some tears, there's always laughter, and it's typically always the same. It's just a tremendous amount of like gratitude and thanks for giving them, you know, something like that to be able to take with them. And, you know, usually there's kids involved, right? Yeah. If they want this kind of thing, it's usually because like their children are there and they want to like capture this one moment with their kids. And so they are always so thankful. So thankful. And that makes a big difference. You know, if you're working and you're putting in all this effort and time and energy and emotion into a project, and then the people are very happy about it and they're very grateful and thankful for it, it makes all the sleepless nights worth it.
And where are you off to next then? What's ahead?
Like I said in the beginning, currently working with Sea Legacy on their catamaran here. So I'm actually captain of the catamaran right now. I met Paul and Christina, the founders of Sea Legacy, in Antarctica last year. They asked me if I would be interested in running this cat because, long story short, I also have a captain's license from yachting that I need to maintain. So I was like, this is a perfect opportunity for me to work with a conservation group that I love, mm-hmm. still be doing filmmaking photography, and as well as captaining this very, very, very cool sailing catamaran. So we are here in the Bahamas for the next couple months, and then we'll go back to Fort Lauderdale for a minute, do a quick yard period, come back, and then start making our way through towards the west coast. So go through the Panama Canal and then do Galapagos, Cocos, Sea of Cortez. There's a bunch of conservation projects there, a lot of incredible wildlife to shoot. And then after that, then we'll start to head over to the South Pacific and eventually the long expedition, the entire idea is to circumnavigate the Pacific, so then make the way up to Japan, Russia, Alaska, like the Aleutians, and then down the coast, British Columbia, and then finish kind of on Vancouver Island. Wow. But that's like you know, 4 or 5 years probably.
So if people want you to come and film for them, presumably they get in touch and they have to wait 5 years until you're off the boat, or they can catch you in between.
Yeah, no, you know, what happens between, I mean, that's the boat's long-term plan. Everything is going very well and I'm thoroughly enjoying myself and I'm absolutely loving being part of this team. So right now I'm doing this and I'm super happy doing it. But everybody knows that I, you know, I have my own thing going as well. So just kind of, you know, as per usual, just riding this wave while it lasts. And, you know, I'm keen to like keep it going for as long as possible and just kind of see where this all plays out. And I'm going to be transitioning hopefully soon towards more of the director of photography kind of stuff on board and be getting more into like the interviewing the BTS and creating as much content for Sea Legacy and for Poland for everybody as well. So yeah, lots of exciting stuff. So if people are interested and they want me to come and shoot the yachts, like feel free to reach out and, you know, they'll see there's breaks coming up and there's definitely potential for work ahead still for sure.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's been lovely talking to you. That's all very interesting. And I'm very jealous, I have to say. Sounds like an incredible job, if a bit tiring.
Yeah, a little bit tiring. Yeah, but thank you very much. I appreciate the time. And yeah, it was fun to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.